The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Let's thank the Lord and get started. Father in heaven, we're very grateful for the privilege that we have of gathering together like this. We commit this time to you. We ask you to bless us in it. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so the rhetoric trap. There's more than one of them, actually. I may touch on a few of them. I hope to. Quintilian once defined rhetoric as the art of a good man speaking well. If you want my commendation on the ancient rhetoricians, I would say out of all of them, I really appreciate Quintilian's common horse sense and his approach to this whole subject of rhetoric. And it begins with his definition. We would make changes to the definition, largely changes of context, but his definition of rhetoric was the art of a good man speaking well. The art of a good man speaking well. Of course, as a pagan, his definition of good is going to be not what we would want. But if you place that statement in a Christian context, I think it is not only defensible, but compelling. Rhetoric is the art of a good man speaking well. But before getting to that, we need to address a couple problems. And the first is the problem that sometimes arises with bookish sorts. As we do this, we also have to deal with another problem, a problem of our postmodern age, which is an age of sophistry, illusion, and posing for the camera. Think of it as teaching rhetoric in the age of the selfie. How do you teach rhetoric in the age of the selfie? How can you teach rhetoric to students, which is that you're teaching them to present themselves well? If you go through Sayers, Paul Perret, poetic stage, when you get to the poetic stage, that's the rhetoric stage. That's where you're teaching students to present themselves well. But the difficulty is you have to teach them how to present themselves with one eye on the mirror without being the kind of person who always has one eye on the mirror. That's the trick. And in the age of the selfie, where you can't look around without seeing some image of something, some flickering image, and we've got all these devices, all these ways of creating new mirrors, it really creates a problem. You want self-awareness in your rhetoric student so that they can step behind a lectern at some point in the future and forget themselves. Right? That's the goal. You want to teach students to learn how to deny themselves. You want them to love the audience, love the group that they're speaking to. And if they're constantly thinking to themselves, how am I coming across? How is this flying? How is this selling? Then that's no good. But you've seen speakers that are constantly striking poses. They're constantly saying, watch them get a load of this. And then... So, the first issue, the issue of bookish sorts, has to do with the difference between learning about it and learning how to do it. Learning about it and learning how to do it. Let me wave a book. I love to wave books, but let me wave a book on this point. This is a new edition of the Seven Laws of Teaching, John Milton Gregory's classic. I wrote a foreword for it, a new foreword for it, and then Dr. Larry Stevenson has a bunch of teacher evaluation tools. There's a bunch of new material in this. But the seven laws are classic, And these seven, and in the seven laws, the first one, I want to give you the first law of teaching and then apply it to rhetoric, because there's something that's, there's an important step that people oftentimes miss. First law is know thoroughly and familiarly the lesson you wish to teach, or, in other words, teach from a full mind and a clear understanding, right? A teacher must be one who knows the lesson or the truth to be taught. A teacher is someone who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Now, here's the difficulty. Rhetoric is much more, it's not as much like a math class as it is like a driver's ed class, okay? If you have, you can have a math teacher who knows the math, and you could have he could teach the math engagingly, and you could have students who want to learn the math because he's a good math teacher, but they don't want to be like him. They don't want to be like the teacher. And that's a problem, of course, in any class. But it's a severe problem in a rhetoric class. It's a severe problem when you're dealing with a skill. If you had a driver's ed teacher who didn't know how to drive, that gives you some sense. If you have a rhetoric teacher who's boring to listen to, if you have a rhetoric teacher who puts the students out, if you have a rhetoric teacher who doesn't know how to put together a phrase, and none of the students want to express themselves at some point in the future like that teacher, you've got a real problem. It's like a driver's ed teacher who runs into a pole every time he tries to show the students, this is how you drive a stick. No, drive a stick, not drive into a stick. So, studying rhetoric texts is not the same thing as being able to speak. Studying ancient rhetoric texts is not the same thing as learning how to speak. Being able to outline the ad herennium is not the same thing as being able to speak. Having the students with their noses in a book, even if it's a great book, even if it's Quintilian, having the students mastering the material and being able to define rhetoric and being able to say, this is what Quintilian argues, this is what Aristotle says, and so on. All of those things, obviously, there's nothing wrong with any of those things. There's nothing wrong with reading the driver's ed manual, right, and passing a test, this is what the signs look like, and this is what you do, and these are the rules. But in a driver's ed course, anybody who took a driver's ed course and when you were done with the manual, you were done, and you'd never gotten behind the wheel, you're missing the entire point. So the point of a rhetoric class ought to be to provide an opportunity for the students to learn how to speak and to do so with coaching or feedback. Rhetoric means speaking. Rhetoric means speaking, and of course, speaking well. And it means having good character and speaking well. Part of the preliminaries would, of course, involve studying other people speaking, or other people talking about people they saw speak. But the central point is to learn how to speak yourself. This means every student regularly speaking. Do it. Right? Do it from week one. Do it. Just start speaking. At NSA, for example, the rhetoric class is taught freshman year, and we have about 50 students on average entering with each class. So we have about 50 incoming freshmen. The structure, I need to explain something about the structure of NSA so that this next observation makes sense. But the structure of NSA is that for our classes, we have a seminar/lecture early in the week for each class. Then the students have a reading list that they're working their way through. So lecture early, and the lecture is an hour or two. And then they have a reading assignment, which is usually for a class, usually for one class, it'd be a book a week. So they'd go to the lecture, hear what the professor has to say, they'd read the book, And then late in the week, we have what are called recitations. In recitations, the class is broken up into smaller sections, and each section meets with the professor to ask questions, be asked questions, to debate and discuss. Those are the recitations. But in rhetoric, it's not broken out into recitations. In rhetoric, recitations are replaced by what we call declamation. So you have the lecture on rhetoric, you've got the reading on rhetoric, and then every week, each student presents something. All right, we got 50 students, and each student presents. Now, obviously, in order to get through it, it has to be just for a few minutes apiece. But you could have the same amount of speaking, right, once a term, have them give a 20-minute address 4 times a year. But I would much rather divvy that time up into 2-minute addresses every week. All right, so every week, you're going to get up in front of your classmates and you're going to say something. Sometimes what you say is you simply get up and read. You're given a book and read us a page. And all you have to do is stand there and read what someone else wrote. And it could be anything from some classic, or it could be Winnie the Pooh or Narnia story. You just have to read and present. And you're learning things like projection and being audible and being comfortable where you are and so on. One of the more fun exercises at declamation is to have 2 students get up at the same time, and they're each given a book, and they have to read in such a way as to capture the attention of the audience. And you're not supposed to cheat by rolling yourself up in the carpet or taking off articles of clothing. What you have to do is read or present in such a way that the people want to listen to you. And then the students decide, okay, which one captured our attention. Then they move into compositions, things that they write themselves, little prose section things. They write 200 words, a few paragraphs that they'll present, prose. There's a section of poetry where they have to write a sonnet and read and present the sonnet that they've written. And everybody does it. Every week, everybody presents. Every week, everybody presents. This is a great help, obviously, in teaching students to learn how to deal with the jitters. Okay? Some of the students, this prospect of speaking weekly to a group of 50 terrifies them. It just really terrifies them. It's also a wonderful way for the entering class to get to know one another, and it's one of the reasons why the classes grow as close together as they do over the course of the year. When after a year of watching someone give a public address every week, you know them pretty well, and they know you. Everybody knows everyone. Because not only do you see them present, but you have heard some of their stories. If you say, tell us about the time you fell out of a tree as a kid. You're telling stories, you're telling experiences, you're learning everybody's sense of humor. You're really getting to know one another very well. And it helps deal with the jitters. And it's really remarkable to watch how the entire class improves and matures and gets more and more comfortable with speaking in front of others after a year of doing this. It's really important to do. It's really important to have them do it. The second preliminary thing to deal with is postmodernism, which is nothing but sophistry in modern guise. Sophistry was an ancient school of thought which has not gone away. It's one of the perennial options, and it's an option that our generation is gobbling up. Now, when I say modern guise, I am not unaware of what I have just done. I said postmodernism is something in modern guise. Modernity has always been relativistic in principle. They've wanted to pretend that they weren't. They've wanted to get a faux objectivity from the formula or from some Cartesian approach. They want to get some sort of objectivity absolute, but modernity has always been relativistic in principle, and the sharper minds among them have always known it. Postmodernism has simply helped us identify the fact that secularism, secularistic modernity, has always been a cul-de-sac. Always been a cul-de-sac. Jean-Paul Sartre said, without an infinite reference point, every finite point is absurd. Without an infinite reference point, every finite point is absurd. And of course, as an existentialist, he wanted us to embrace the absurdity. But any thinking person, any sharp sophomore, after 10 minutes of thought, can tell you, without an infinite reference point, every finite point is meaningless, absurd. You don't call it post-leprosy just because another finger fell off, right? Just because it's gotten a little bit worse or a little bit more obvious doesn't mean you're post anything. Now, the textbook that we use for the NSA class is the Rhetoric Companion that I and Nate, my son, wrote. Both of us have taught the course for various stints and various times. And the textbook, that textbook, begins by considering what Paul meant in his full-throated attack on rhetoric. All right? Paul attacks rhetoric. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 through 25. We really ought to be more, if the Apostle Paul always also attacks philosophy, right? In vain philosophy. Now, this is when I went to school, I majored in philosophy. I got my BA in philosophy. I got my master's in philosophy. People used to say, "What are you going to do with that?" I would say, "I am going to work at Taco Time. I am going to be the one in the back saying, 'What is a taco?'" When you come to think about it, what is a taco? Well, if the Apostle Paul attacks philosophy, if the Apostle Paul attacks rhetoric, and he does, then surely if we're going to recover the lost tools of learning and we're going to return to the study of the classics and we're going to teach our students philosophy and we're going to have a rhetoric class and we're going to teach them rhetoric, shouldn't we at least have something to say about the parts of the Bible that appear to be assaulting what we're teaching? I think we should. I don't think we should just blow it off, because if we blow it off, we are going to be very susceptible to what the Apostle Paul is very worried about. There is a trap here, and this is one of the central traps. John Piper, we begin this rhetoric text by interacting with what Paul is warning us about. John Piper does the same thing in the introduction to his recent book, very fine book, Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully. Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully. It's one part of his series. He's dealing with three lives. He's addressing George Herbert and Whitfield and C.S. Lewis in this book. But the introduction of this book is classic. The introduction to this book, Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully, is just classic. If you are teaching rhetoric, or if you need a gift for your rhetoric teacher, this book would be a great one. Just the introduction would be worth everything. He does the same thing. How do we deal with Paul's warning? I want to teach people how to speak eloquently. I want to teach people how to speak effectively. I want to teach people how to present themselves well. So how do I deal with Paul's taunts? Where's the debater? Where's the wise man? Where's the scholar of this age? Where Paul gives the whole thing the raspberry, it appears to be. Do not teach rhetoric to your students unless and until you and they understand the object of Paul's scorn in that passage. He is attacking the core tenets of the sophists. He is attacking the core tenets of the sophists, and Corinth was teeming with them. Corinth was a place where the sophists had a strong presence. Now, the sophists would speak for a fee, and they did not care for our quaint notions of objective or absolute truth. One of the great characteristics of sophistry was rhetorical boasting. Now, in all the rhetoricians in the ancient world, there's more of a boasting element than you find in Christian teaching of rhetoric. I think that's just par for the course with Christian versus pagan. But the sophists embraced it. The sophists went all in. One of their great characteristics was their boasting, which Paul makes a particular target. Let him who boasts boast in the Lord. All right? The boasting is inescapable. It's not whether you're going to boast, it's what you're going to boast in. And Paul's saying, you must do it in the Lord. You can't do it in your own eloquence. You cannot do it in, you cannot boast in your own skill. You cannot boast in your own stage presence and so on. So Paul is not targeting the effective use of language, because in this section, Paul is using language very effectively. All right? So what rhetoric ought to be is on display in 1 Corinthians 1. What rhetoric ought to be: a passion for the truth, boldness in declaring it, and the clarity of the point is very much on display by the Apostle Paul. There are places in Paul where he rises to stupendous rhetorical heights. Later on in this letter, 1 Corinthians 13, that whole passage on love, that great celebration of love, is rhetorically powerful. Paul knew, he was no sophist. So when he says, when he talks about the sophists say that my physical presence is, miserable, it's mean, it's contemptible. He's not saying that he was ineffective. He was saying that he didn't obey their rules. He didn't follow their customs. He didn't accept their notions of what an effective speech or sermon or presentation was. He belonged to a different school of thought. And it was not that the sophist said you've got to be effective and Paul said, no, sermons and presentations and so forth ought to be ineffective. No, it's effective versus effective, competing claims of effectiveness on different foundations, different goals, different assumptions about what a talk ought to be. So Paul is not targeting Quintilian's definition of rhetoric as being a good man speaking well. Right, how would Paul argue with that? A good man speaking well. Right, that's what Paul was. He was a good man, and he was speaking well. He is explicitly targeting the sophistic approach, which is that of a clever but rootless man speaking to unanchored applause. A clever but rootless man speaking to unanchored, untethered applause. It's like watching a fireworks display. Ooh, look at embellishment. Look at that metaphor. Whee, That kind of thing is not Christian preaching. It's not Christian teaching. When the Holy Spirit works in Christian proclamation, the people are pierced to the heart. They're cut to the heart. There's some fellow, I've forgotten his name, I'm sorry, who said very wisely, a man cannot simultaneously give the impression that he is clever and that Christ is mighty to save. Those are two competing goals. Another way of thinking of this is a speaker ought to be a window through which you can see the truth. He should not be a spectacle at which you stare. Right? If he becomes the spectacle, if he becomes the object of your admiration, then he's failing with a Christian definition of rhetoric. A Christian definition of rhetoric is to lead the listener to the truth. So I mentioned postmodernism earlier. So Paul is attacking sophistry, and I mentioned postmodernism earlier, and this is key. Postmodern assumptions have seeped into everything, including the hearts and minds of many of your students. I say this because at NSA we have to deal with this routinely, constantly. I can tell you that the Evangelical Church, the Reformed Church, the classical and Christian school movement, and all our other friends and relations are not coming through this relativistic era unscathed. We are taking casualties. We are taking casualties. If we were a ship, we would be taking on water. It is not the case that our students are just serenely encapsulated in this bubble of the classical Christian school, and all the relativistic assumptions that are carried in television commercials and on billboards and in pop songs I listen to on the radio, and all the culture, the atmosphere that we're living in is saturated with this set of assumptions. And it's the age of the selfie. And in the age of the selfie, if I were to say to your students, what's a selfie, would they all say, we don't know. We're in this bubble. We don't know. No, they're really not in the bubble. The answer to all this is we should be able to easily say, but we must also be able to see, is Christ. And in order to be able to see Christ in this era, we have to do what Paul did in his era. We have to learn a deep and abiding contempt of being cool. Because that's the carrier of all this. In the modern era, cool is sophistry. In the modern era, cool is postmodern. Now, I don't mean, I'm not fussing over terms. If someone says, oh, I just got a great deal on snow tires at Les Schwab, and you say, cool, all right, I'm not talking about that. Right? I'm not talking about that. I am talking about the hipster vibe. I am talking about the whole cultural embodiment of rootlessness. I am talking about the when you're detached from the infinite reference point, then not only does every finite point become absurd, but every finite point and the point right next to you become the only thing you have, and so you clutch at it. So without an infinite reference point, every finite point is absurd, and every finite point is all you have. And so you invest everything in that, and you start posing. Well, Christian rhetoric is the enemy of posing. Christian rhetoric is the enemy of posing. Sophistry is posing. Right, those two things are at eternal and everlasting odds with one another. So, I say on the outline that I wanted to tell a few war stories. If we consider the rhetoric classes at Logos and New St. Andrews as positioned somewhere on the front lines of this business, as your rhetoric class is, as your school is, let me tell you some war stories. And they're not terrible, but they just, and it fits in with this whole discussion. One time during declamation, one of my better students was giving her presentation to the class. I was sitting off to the side, so if she was standing here at the lectern, I was sitting off to the side in the front, and then the class was out front. She was giving her presentation, and she was addressing the class. According to her usual custom, she was prepared, pretty, poised, polished. You notice the alliteration there? Don't do that too much. Unless you're doing Anglo-Saxon. During the course of her talk, she was just together. She's the kind of person that I wouldn't have been embarrassed to have come and address the convention here. This is what we're talking about. This is what we're doing. Well, during the course of her talk, I happened to glance down. I was over the side. Happened to glance down, and I saw the back hem of her skirt, which was shaking like an aspen in a stiff breeze. She was terrified. She was just totally terrified. And above the lectern, it was a calm summer day. She was just, it wasn't exactly like an Irish step dancer, you know, behind, but she was in a state of high tension. And that's one of the things I tell students, don't hold your papers like this, Because if you've got the slightest tremor in your hand, by the time it gets out to the end of the paper, it's doing that. Well, her skirt was doing that. Some students look like, and this is my point, some students look like they don't need the practice, but they do. Everybody needs to get up there every week. If you've got someone who did a great rhetorical presentation in high school, if you've got someone who just really, for all intents and purposes, they've arrived, the first day of class, you see them speak for the first time and you say, man, I'd just be willing to give them an A for the class now. Well, they still need, it's still beneficial for them to get up. It's still beneficial for them to do what they do. My wife has taught rhetoric at Logos, and when the students present regularly, as they do there as well, it's the same. It's not the same system, but it's the same philosophy of having the students present regularly on a schedule. When the students present regularly, you can shake a lot of things out. If the students came up to the front, this is one of Nancy's rules, if the students came up to the front and their first words were, okay, or so, they had to go sit down again. You come up to the front and you say, so. It's a gong show sort of thing. And she taught the course. If during the course of the talk they said, or awesome, the class was trained to erupt into a chorus of, oh no, oh, or the equivalent, and they'd go sit down again, right? So you get up and you say, awesome, whoa, throw popcorn. You can do that kind of thing more effectively at the high school level than at the college level, but practice really does deal with the jitters. Let me say something about awesome. Years ago, when I was teaching at Logos, I had declared my own private war on the word awesome because it was just beginning to catch hold at that time. And I would tell the students, look, the Grand Canyon is awesome. Galaxies are awesome. God is awesome. Your quiz scores are not awesome. You know. And I would say, I would get up in front of him and say, I confess defeat. I know that I cannot make you stop saying that. I confess. I cannot make you stop saying that. But I can behave in such a way this year that you will never say it again for the rest of your life without thinking of me. You know, say awesome, then you start looking for, you hear footsteps. Practice really does deal with the jitters. And there's no way to do this except by doing it. Have the students do it. Have them get used to it. Have them get accustomed to it. Nancy had one Korean student who got rattled in the middle of her talk and switched languages back to Korean. Got caught up in the moment. And some of this, you've got to be pastorally sensitive and careful and everything, but, you know, one student would break out into blotches whenever she would speak. But it got better over the course of the year. Right? Everybody know, you know, if you get up and your face turns into this piebald thing, you know, let's do this thing together. We're in this thing together. We could avoid all that awkwardness. You know, you're going to deal with speech impediments and people who get, you know, you're going to be dealing with all sorts of things like that. But deal with it with grace and kindness and firmness because it's a rhetoric class, right? That's what we're doing. Let's do this thing together. One of the rules that Nate has for rhetoric in his teaching of the course is his flat prohibition of English accents. An exception is made for our students from England. Because we're just charitable that way. But for the Americans, the rule is laid down. It really is amazing. If you're a native speaker, well, I need to illustrate this. If you've watched the Birdie and Jeeves, the Hugh Laurie, the BBC thing, later on in the series, there's one episode where there's an obnoxious American millionaire. And I remember the first time I watched that, staring at the screen, thinking, what is wrong with that man? You know, what is wrong with that man? And at some point it dawned on me what was so awful about it. I realized it was a Brit speaking in an American accent. Something was terribly, terribly wrong, and I'm not sure what it is, but he's clearly an American, but it was half a bubble off. And it just really, so even if you do it very, very well, which this guy was doing, he wasn't nailing it. He wasn't nailing it. And if you have high school students doing an English accent, because, and this will, let's be frank, this will almost always be the girls, too much Anne of Green Gables or something. The no English accents. We once had a bad experience with an accent mangling. We have a weekly disputatio at the college, so we have the recitations and the declamations, but also every Friday the whole college gets together and we have presentations and panel discussions and debates, and occasionally students will read poetry and do a presentation like that. And we had a bad experience with an accent, an English accent, mangling the Lady of Shalott. Shalott. I wasn't quite sure how she did it, but it was not good. Rhetoric is not pretending to be somebody else. Rhetoric is learning how to be a disciplined and honest version of yourself. Rhetoric includes becoming a disciplined and honest version of yourself. You are after the inculcation of confidence and clarity. This is something Piper points out in the introduction to Seeing Beauty. Confidence. What does Paul pray? When Paul is going to speak, what does he pray for? What does he ask the people to pray for him for? He prays that they would pray that he would have boldness. It's confidence. That he'd be able to stand up boldly. Now, in some cases, the jitters are going to be a part of that. But in other places, we have to recognize that one time an Anglican clergyman one time made the observation, everywhere the Apostle Paul went, there was either a revival or a riot. He said, everywhere I go, they serve tea. So when Paul's asking for boldness, it's likely not the case after decades of apostolic ministry. It's likely not the case that he was asking for prayer because he had butterflies when he would get up and talk. That's probably stage fright was probably not his issue. It was probably more the prospect of being dragged outside the city, stoned, and left for dead, because this is what happens when I speak. Well, he would pray for boldness, but there is something compelling about confidence. There's something rhetorically compelling about boldness. Now, that means that there's going to be a knockoff. That means there will be counterfeits of that. So bombast, raw dogmatism, that sort of thing gets subbed in by many people, because if you just proclaim loudly, then people will mistake it for confidence and boldness. The other thing Paul asks for prayer, that I would be able to make it clear, as I should. One of the things that you should do in good writing, good speaking, is say, and this goes back to the first law in the seven laws of teaching, the teacher should know what it is he's trying to say. What's the point? What am I trying to get across? Now, and that's also one of the things that the study of rhetoric enables you to do. Stasis theory is the approach that enables you to break down a question to get to the essential issue. Right? What's the essential point? What's the point under discussion? When you are, and this would be helpful in a debate or in a point-counterpoint presentation, or when you're giving any kind of speech that engages with a philosophy or a worldview that you don't agree with, when that happens, you don't want to spend your time scurrying around the tree of falsehood pulling off leaves. Right? You don't want to be pulling off leaves and twigs. You want to fire up the chainsaw. Right? What's the trunk of this thing? What's the aspect of this false philosophy which, if I take it out with a chainsaw, the whole thing comes down, and I don't have to worry about the twigs and the leaves. Too often, when students are in debate classes, and nothing against debate classes, nothing against learning how to debate, but too often, if you are anchored to a certain process, 10 minutes, this, that, and the other, one of the things that you make the mistake of doing is you forget stasis theory, you forget what the central point is, you forget to look for it, and you're just writing down everything the person says, and you try to answer each one of them. But you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to answer the one thing or the handful of things, which, if you make your case, the whole thing topples. Another important issue in teaching rhetoric is this, let me change gears slightly. One of the ways that standards slip in educational institutions is that we first develop tests that we think are comprehensive. We develop tests that we think are comprehensive. And oftentimes, we are not teaching the material of the class. We find ourselves at the end of the day teaching students how to take tests. Or we're teaching students how to take our tests. These tests, if they're comprehensive, bury the teacher in the process of grading at stated intervals. So finals week or midterms, the teacher has to take home a stack of papers or a stack of tests and finals, and then they have to use their break grading all the papers. Now, there's a certain element of that that's just simply inescapable, and taking written tests makes all kinds of sense in a math class. It makes all kinds of sense if you're talking about a composition class, written compositions. It makes all kinds of sense to do that. So that's what we ought to do. In a rhetoric class, it doesn't make that much sense. But if you're anchored to this mountain of tests, it's not long before tests start creeping in that are much easier to grade. Are multiple choice tests so popular because they tell you the very most about what the student knows? No. Oftentimes it tells you which students are the cleverest and the best at statistics. Okay? 4 multiple choice answers. 2 of them are outlandish. I've got 2 remaining possibilities. I've got a 50-50 chance. Right? And they can oftentimes noodle their way through multiple choice tests. Now, I'm not saying multiple choice tests are sinful or wrong or anything, but oftentimes the pressure there is not to find the thing that tells you the most, gives you the most feedback on how the student is doing. You opt for a form of test taking that doesn't make the teacher's life miserable over break, or the teacher's life impossible over break. In a related area, a similar phenomenon, someone once described education as a process whereby information gets from the teacher's outline into the student's notebook without passing through the mind of either. Okay, not good. So, in rhetoric class, learn to grade on the fly. Now, that sounds haphazard. I don't mean haphazardly. But give feedback immediately. When the students are presenting, give feedback in that class, in that moment, when everybody remembers what it was that they just did. Coach them in the moment, like the director of a play or the conductor of an orchestra or choir. Coach them in the moment. Don't take a stack of papers up to Mount Olympus in order to make inscrutable decisions signaled by indecipherable markings in red. And when the paper is returned to them after Christmas break, and they don't remember what they said or why they said it, and they have to remind themselves when they look at the paper again. Now, there are places where you must give that kind of feedback. But in the places where you don't have to give that kind of feedback, and you could do the student a lot of good if you simply gave feedback in the moment, then give them feedback in the moment. In rhetoric especially, have the students, and I'm not just talking about finals, I'm talking about the regular ongoing presentations. Have the students speak routinely and evaluate them as they go. And when the class period is over, your grading is done. Right? You said, all right, I told Murphy last week not to shuffle his feet so much, you know, plant his feet and stand behind the lectern. I told him to do this, and I told him to hold the lectern, don't wave his hands that much. Let's say that's the feedback you gave. So then he gets up next time, he's doing the Irish step dance, and he's waving his arms, and he's doing all of this. Then you say, okay, and you mark him down, 80, I give him an 80 on that presentation. And then when he's done, you tell him what he just did. Now remember, I told you not to move around so much. I told you not to, And he gets the feedback. He gets the feedback right now. It's all fresh. And you've got your evaluation of him in the book already. Why do we think we have to get it onto paper first and then take it off the paper in order to put it in the book? Just grade, interact with your students, evaluate your students as you go. So, learn to distinguish the kinds of tests that tell you what you need to know and the kind of tests that are simply easy to grade. Take care that you're not making a teacher-friendly zone that helps students slide into some kind of cozy zone where everything is predictable. Now, I have no quarrel with a teacher-friendly zone as long as the teacher-friendliness lines up with the course objectives. You've got certain things that you want to get done in the course, and if you're getting those things done, then figure out the simplest way to get there without crushing the teacher under a rock pile of extraneous work. When we start teaching our students rhetoric, really, when we start teaching them how to speak effectively, really, it will be hard to keep that a secret. It will be hard to keep that under wraps. The authority will come from the truth of the substance of what they are saying, and the authority of their speaking will be related. The substance has the ring of truth, the authority of the truth, if you're speaking the truth. And in fact, the truth is so authoritative that it is exercising that authority over the way the speaker is approaching his lecture or talk or sermon. Christ is Lord of everything, including how we put our words together and including how we write or say them. Christ is the Word. If Christ is the Word, then and we are Christ's people, we are to be people of the Word. That's what we're called to do. That's what we're called to be. Be people of the Word. That means learning to work with words. That means loving words. That means giving yourself to words. That means studying how the words go together and studying how the words don't go together. Why are they effective when they are effective? Why are they ineffective when they are ineffective? And it all goes back to Jesus right away. And if you're having your students read good words, they're coming into contact with good words. If they're seeing, that's the other thing, is if all the students wrote their talk and turned it into you and it came back to them with red on their paper, maybe one or two of them would show other students what the feedback they got. But if you're coaching the whole class and they're presenting, they present, and you give feedback to student A, student B and C and D are thinking, oh, I do that too, I do that too. Everybody, as long as you're not teaching them in a way that is personally humiliating, what you're doing is you're giving, there may be some awkwardness in the first 2 or 3 weeks when you're establishing your right to do this, but when people get accustomed to it, when the students get accustomed to it, they covet it, and they covet it even though it's done in public, even though the interaction is done in public. I mentioned earlier that I've taught rhetoric and at NSA, and my son Nate is teaching rhetoric now. He's taught it for 10, 11, 12 years. I've taught it off and on for a number of years. And in the feedback at the end of declamation, I do that, and Nate does that. Nate is much sharper, much more pointed in his criticisms, shall we say, than I am. I'm just a nice guy. And sometimes I feel bad about it because, there's another thing is Nate's not the pastor and I am the pastor, and I could, if I unloaded on some, and she's a puddle and, you don't want to do that. You want to be, you want to have the criticism be pointed and helpful and so forth. But one of the things I've noticed is that the differences in the classes, Nate's pointedness of feedback is valued and appreciated and sought after by the class. They want that kind of feedback. They want, now of course they don't want to be embarrassed, but they want feedback. They want to become better. They want to get better at what they're doing. And if you are reluctant to say anything in front of the other students, there are things that you just don't, there are some things that you would take them aside and tell them privately. But 80, 90% of all the feedback that you're going to give is feedback you could figure out a good way to say in front of the class, give it to them in front of the class, and the whole class benefits with each speaker. The whole class is learning. You're, like I said earlier, you see your role as a conductor or a choir director or the director of a play. All right, so before we close in prayer, we've got 5 minutes, so I can take a question or two if we have one. See, I was so clear. Wow. Okay, the question was, what have we found in the physical production of sound, elocution, enunciation, things like that? Okay. Yes, there is a section on that in the Rhetoric Companion that I mentioned. That's one of the things that we cover. Let me give you an example. This is one of the reasons why we teach poetry. We teach poetry in rhetoric, is prose speaking has a metrical element. Syllables are either stressed or unstressed, and how you stress, where you place the stress, one of the assignments that we have the students decide is what kind of instrument are you, all right? You pretend you're all a musical instrument. What are you? Well, some of the young ladies are little piccolos, right? They're high voice and that sort of thing. And if she tries to be an authoritative, dominate the lectern kind of presence, it's just going to be a piccolo joke, right? That doesn't mean that the piccolo doesn't have a role, but you have to learn, all right, what instrument are you? If there's some things you can't change, like the pitch of your voice, there are other things that you can change. So if you are slurring your words, if you're failing to enunciate, you can be taught to hit the stresses of your, and this is one of the things that you can learn in the poetry section, because you learn how stress works, right? Which syllables here are stressed. So in an iambic poem, when the I am, da-da, da-da, ironically, I am is not an I am, but da-da, 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 da-da. And they learn to identify where the stress marks are, and you learn how to pace yourself. All of it, there's a whole section in the rhetoric text on posture, gesture, eye contact, enunciation, all of that. And so I would say that's the, and then there I forget if there are any resource footnotes there, but that would be the place I would refer you. Anything else? Well, let's pray. Father, thank you for our time together here now. We commit it all to you. I pray that you would bless the students that are represented by their teachers here. I pray you bless them this coming fall, and I pray that it would be a better, more fruitful year because of this time that we spent here now. We commit it to you in Jesus' name. Amen.